Welcome to Politics Unpacked, the series where we explain one of the biggest news topics of the day, then debate the issue with the TLDR team. Over the last couple of weeks, we've been hearing more and more about COVID vaccines from Pfizer, Moderna, and now Oxford University. That's because it was announced this week that the Oxford vaccine is set to be 70% effective and could even be as high as 90% effective. So in this episode, we'll look at the future. What does this Oxford vaccine mean for us getting back to normal? Is the 70% figure good news or bad news? And how will this vaccine and others end up being distributed? This is Politics Unpacked. Now that it's been announced that there are three effective vaccines that are now simply awaiting regulatory approval, questions are starting to be asked about how they'll be used to end the pandemic. Well, the Joint Committee on Vaccine and Immunisation has a list of priorities of people who need to be vaccinated more quickly. As you'd expect, the more vulnerable are higher up on this list. Once the most vulnerable get the vaccine, less vulnerable people will also be able to get their hands on it. It's been reported that 42 mass vaccination centres will open, which will vaccinate between 2,000 and 5,000 people per day. The UK is reported to have purchased 350 million vaccines from the leading six vaccine candidates, which is more than enough to immunise the whole of the UK and Crown dependencies. Obviously, the UK plans to export some of these vaccines to countries that need them, and this is in line with the commitments made by other G20 countries. Exactly which vaccines the UK will choose to use, both at home and to export, depends on many different factors. The fact that the vaccines are all different and have their own strengths and weaknesses certainly mean that the government has a difficult decision to make. Both the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines have a high efficiency rate, but they're much more costly and need to be stored at very cold temperatures. While the Oxford vaccine may be less efficient, it's far cheaper and far easier to store and transport at warmer temperatures. So in this episode of Politics Unpacked, we'll discuss the Oxford vaccine and what it means for ending the pandemic.
So I'm joined with Josh and Nelson, and we're going to discuss just generally kind of how the vaccines are going and specifically the news about the Oxford vaccine today. I think one of the big things I want to talk about with you both is the actual rollout of the vaccine, because I think quite a lot of people have been asking about that and seem to see that as sort of like the route out of the pandemic. So I think that's probably one of the big things to discuss.
So today we were told that the final stage of the trials had come out and that the initial effectiveness was 70%, but depending on how the dosages were assigned, I believe if you had a half dose first and then a second dose afterwards, it could have been upwards of 90%. And that's to add on to the stories you've had from last week where the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines have come back with sky high effectiveness rates in excess of 90, 95%. So it's just, we are seeing three competitive vaccines coming through at a time when we need them, and it's good to see that there are different vaccine technologies coming to the fore, so that if one doesn't get approval by the regulator, there is another to fall back on.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to point out the sort of differences between the vaccines in terms of storage, because it's easy to point out that, I mean, it seems unfair sort of like to categorise, as some of the media has done, that the Oxford vaccine is only 70% effective. And I think that while it is 70% effective, as you pointed out with the single dose, if you have the first vaccine with a lower dose and then the second vaccine with a higher dose, it can go up to 90% effectiveness. And not only that, but the Oxford vaccine is not only a lot cheaper than the other vaccines, but it can also be stored between 2 and 8 degrees Celsius for a month, which is a long time. Whereas a couple, the other two big vaccines, one of them has to be kept, really, isn't it something like minus
80 or something, isn't it?
Yeah, minus 80 degrees Celsius, something like really. Mm. And then the other one is still, I think, in the negatives. So the fact that the Oxford vaccine is really cheap, I think it's about £3 a dose, £3 a dose. And then the other two are, in excess of like $20. So it's a cheap vaccine, and it's not, you know, laborious to store. So there are advantages to the Oxford vaccine, and so it does. It's really positive news today, and it means that we've got three vaccines that could that are effective and could be used to end, you know, this hellish year of lockdowns and everything. So it's all good news. Mm-hmm. What do you both think about the sort of optimistic Johnson? Like the I mean, he's been quite, you know, he's been managing expectations, but he seems to have been a bit more uplifting in the last week and about, you know, hopeful. I think, was it Matt Hancock as well the other day that said that he hoped it'd be over by Easter? So what do you both think about that? Do you think that's a realistic expectation, or do you think that this is more of a sort of best case scenario?
I was just going to say, just the way it's being reported about the vaccines and how they, you know, they've got quite a lot of doses of the Oxford one. They've got quite a lot of doses of the Pfizer one. And I know they're sort of, they're not all immediately available, and they're going to be supposed to be available in the new year and stuff. But like, it does feel to me that there's sort of some kind of end in sight here, and sort of some kind of time frame. Like, we always knew there was going to be an end in sight, but like, there's a time frame ish for it now. And I think Boris is like a human as well. He's probably like just feeling good about it himself as well as, you know, having
that's the
wanting
sort of
to
deep
sort of
analysis we expect from TLDR Josh. Boris Johnson is a human.
Well, he's probably excited himself to, you know, get out and do normal things again. And but obviously
go,
you know,
for a double date with Carrie.
Who would the double anyway? You're off
Matt Hancock. I don't know. Sorry, I'm just
actually marry Simmons because they're not married, are they?
Oh yeah, of course. Boris Johnson's waiting on a wedding. Yeah, yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah,
he's waiting until, you know, it's not just 20 people. He's got to sort of manage expectations, but he's got to be positive himself and try and get people like feeling a bit more positive again. But I know it does seem like we now sort of know when the light at the end of the tunnel is coming. If you see what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that Johnson also, prior to, you know, this pandemic and everything, he was more of the sort of feel-good politician. He was the one embarking on these really big projects as Mayor of London. He was the one, you know, overseeing the you know, London Olympics, everything like that. Some other prime ministers come across as the more sort of serious politicians who deal with the serious issues. You know, like David Cameron overseeing austerity, irrespective of his views on austerity and that Conservative government, he came across more of sort of a very serious, very stern sort of prime minister, I think. Whereas Johnson came in as more of sort of the uplifting, more optimistic prime minister. I think that's quite a difficult position for him to be in at the minute, because you need to manage those expectations. People are desperately wanting something to cling on to, hope-wise. I mean, I am as well. Everybody is, irrespective of sort of how involved you are with politics or not. Everybody's wanting to cling on to things to be hopeful about. And he's had to manage those expectations, which I think is a very weird position for him to be in, as I say, because of his sort of optimistic tone as a politician. But I think he's done that. And I think that from what I've seen about the vaccines and vaccine rollout, which I'm sure we're going to talk about in a second, about exactly how the vaccine is going to be rolled out, I think that mid of next year seems like a realistic sort of time period. I think some people were maybe clinging to the vaccine being completed by the end of this year, getting the vaccine out and having this done and dusted by the new year. But obviously that was clearly a bit too optimistic. And even if the vaccine was created by them, which is seeming like it will, it's not going to be rolled out in time, but hopefully early next year, mid next year, things will start going back to some form of normality. I think that is a realistic expectation to have.
The only thing I would add is that we've seen Johnson change his tone, because when the very first vaccine results were announced, he was Mr. Cautious. He was, let's wait. It's just one vaccine. It could go wrong. But now we've got three vaccines, and more importantly, the Oxford vaccine is a more conventional vaccine, in that it's the tried and tested way that we've done flu vaccines before. So I think that's what's given him that boost, that ability to now be confident and be his optimistic self.
And probably because they've got, like, you know, I can't remember how many doses it is, but they've said they've got loads and loads ready for
100 million.
Yeah, like, you know, that's... Mm-hmm. That's going to almost cover the whole population on its own.
Well, he made very clear that in total, the UK has ordered, I think he said about 300 million doses, which...
What we've got to remember about this as well, sorry, Ben, is like, is, you know, we're going to obviously probably talk about immunity in a second, but if you don't get like lifelong immunity and it has to be an annual jab or something, it's not like, you know, we've got 100 million doses and that's it. Yeah. They're going to keep making them. Like, it's not like we're going to run out of it. So, like, these are just sort of like the preliminary amounts of doses
exactly.
we've got.
But he made very clear that 300 million initial doses, as you correctly sort of point out, those 100 million doses should be enough to immunise the UK and Crown dependencies as well. So it's, you know, 65 million people in the UK, but obviously there's also, you know, places like Falkland Islands, Gibraltar, places like that that will also need them. And then also there's talk of, and absolutely rightly so, of vaccine nationalism and trying to get over that mindset. Yeah. Because this virus spreads, you know, very quickly. You know, it's our number naturally is above 3. So as long as you have airports open and as long as people are moving between countries, this virus will spread. So, you know, irrespective of what your views are on any, you know, form of politics, that, you know, from a scientific standpoint, unless you do get that vaccine, you know, across all countries and try and, you know, reduce the R number in all countries, you're not going to get rid of this virus and you're not going to reduce it significantly. So, you know, people need to get out of this mindset of vaccine nationalism, and the reason we bought so many is so that we can then export some to, you know, other countries as well.
Yeah, well,
so that's a really key point to point out.
Two things on that, actually. I saw something the other day where it's like someone, I can't remember if it was an American politician or a Mexican politician, basically said, you won't eradicate COVID in the US until you eradicate COVID in Mexico.
The other thing that I wanted to raise as well was that we've all, I think people are kind of looking at this and kind of almost jumping too quickly to what this vaccine can do for us. And that's a very natural thing to do. And I did it as well. But I think it's important for everybody to sort of bear in mind how much of an achievement this is.
Yeah.
Like, it is a remarkable achievement and how quickly it's been done. Of all three vaccines, how long vaccines normally takes, decades
it's
normally.
Apparently, it's also been like it's 10 years working a year. And but on that, actually, as I was reading something where they were saying it's not, obviously, they've done incredible work, but it's not like they just saw COVID at the start of this year and thought, we'll get going with a vaccine now. Apparently, they started like planning for the next pandemic when Ebola happened. Like, after Ebola, when everyone was unprepared for that, they started like preparing for this. And so they were able to sort of just like, you know, alter what they already had to fit COVID.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of work in a short amount of time, and it's a lot of prior preparation, which I think they should be very commended for.
But they had to map this particular virus, understand how it works, and create a vaccine, all whilst dealing with the restrictions. So be it working from home or social distancing, they've had a storm of restrictions put on them, and they've still managed to come through.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly it. I mean, it must have been an incredibly hard year already to be working and to be working on something so important, but the fact they've managed to compress a decade's worth of work down to 1 year in some of the hardest working conditions that scientists have probably had due to coronavirus restrictions is absolutely phenomenal. And to add on top of that, I think people as well, and I had this as well this morning when I opened my phone for the first time and saw that the Oxford vaccine came in at 70% effective. You know, even if this two-dose thing turns out not to work and it's 70% effective, that's still a remarkably high, you know, number, effectiveness, when you compare it to other vaccines, like the flu jab, which is, what, around 50%? Is that right? Around 50% sort of effective?
Yeah, that range. And they were like, all these, when these trials were going on, you know, you've heard from scientists saying, like, they would have bitten your hand off at, like, 60% or something.
Yeah.
And they've produced, could be 90%. It's, you know, I don't really know anything about vaccines until all this has been kicking off, but that's like, I think they've shocked themselves, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, even the most optimistic scientists were hoping for about like 60-70%, and to have two that are definitively at 95% and one that is possibly even at 90% is an absolutely phenomenal achievement. And I think, you know, people shouldn't be looking at the 70% and comparing it to the other two and looking at, oh, well, it's not that great. I mean, the Oxford vaccine is cheaper, a lot cheaper to produce. It's easier to store. So there's advantages and disadvantages to each. And if the Oxford vaccine is even 90%, if it goes up to 90%, that is an absolutely remarkable achievement. So I think that's the important thing, you know, to point out. And I think we've made that point. So that's good. So
sure. I was just a tiny thing to add. And the fact that none of them have safety concerns.
Yeah.
None of them have any major safety concerns. It's like, So what if it was 60%? Just take the jab. Mm. If it's not going to do you any harm and you have a chance of doing well,
but
it's in the best interest.
On that though, like, is there not an argument that you could say these tests have only been going on for a few months? You don't know the long term side effects. There might not be short term side effects, but obviously, you know, I'm in the camp of get the vaccine. But you can understand why some people are a bit hesitant. Because I'm not saying they've cut any corners, but just with things like this, you can't tell the long-term effects.
Yeah, but then you can make the argument that we're still unsure about the long-term effects of COVID itself.
Yeah.
So it's which one do you want? Do you want the virus and that effect, yeah, or do you want the vaccine and that effect?
The other thing to bear in mind as well is that they haven't cut any corners, to my knowledge. What they've done is they've run the different stages of the vaccine rollout simultaneously
in parallel,
so that. Normally that wouldn't be cost effective, because you'd get to one stage of the vaccine, of making the vaccine, and you'd turn around and go, right, so it's not going to work, so we won't continue with it. So then you won't spend the money on the next stage. So that's cost efficient. With this, cost efficiency is not a concern, because we need to get this vaccine out as quickly as possible, because you're absolutely trashing economies. So what they've done is they've run them in parallel. You know, if it fails at another one, at an earlier stage, and you're still running the later stage, yes, you've wasted the money on that. But if it did turn out to prove to be effective, you don't have to, you know, wait for the next stage to be run. So from my understanding, they haven't cut corners in the sense that they're not running, you know, the efficacy and the safety, you know, and the clinical trials as they normally would. They have. They just ran them simultaneously to the other stages. So there's all that. But anyway, let's move on to the actual deployment of the vaccine, because I think that's something that you know, a lot of people have questions about, exactly how we're going to get from where we are today to, you know, back to normal, and how is the vaccine going to be rolled out to people? Exactly how do we get there, sort of thing?
What's it called? The Joint Committee on Vaccines and Immunisation. They've basically produced, they're like advising the government, they basically just produce the list of how it's going to be deployed. So you've got care home residents and care home workers, then everyone over 80 and people working in the NHS and social care. And then basically it just keeps going down the ages until you get to about 65, where it says moderate risk, high risk adults under 65 and moderate risk adults under 65, before you then get to all those over 60. So it's sort of, I think that's just in line with risk in terms of COVID in general, sort of age and then underlying health conditions. But it's interesting that it's going in age order for quite a way before they get to the underlying health conditions, I thought. But anyway, that's irrelevant, really.
So how do you see the actual, how is the vaccine actually going to be rolled out? Like, what's the sort of logistics of how it's going to be rolled out to everybody?
In my view, I think it's going to be a combination of using the existing flu vaccine infrastructure we have, and that's been expanded recently in the past few days. And then GPs are going to be the front line of vaccinations, in that they are medically trained to do so. They know the most vulnerable people in their community. So being at the front line, they are best placed to vaccinate the population.
So from my understanding, the way that the vaccine is going to be rolled out is that you'll have these sort of what they're calling mass vaccination centres. So there would be 42 of these sort of placed around the UK, I believe it's the UK, or is it England? I think it's England, because Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland have devolved powers on health. So you'll have these 42 centres that are placed around England, which people will be able to go to and get the vaccine. These have been, you know, started to be announced which ones they are. I think one of them is in Derby Arena is going to be used, and some of the reasons for using that is it's got a lot of space inside it, and you know, good parking, good transport routes. So people would obviously go to these centres and get the vaccine. From my understanding, they're going to use a combination, and it's also, just before I get onto that, it was also reported that the each of these 42 mass vaccination centres will be able to vaccinate between 2,000 and 5,000 people per day, which is obviously a really phenomenal, would be an absolutely phenomenal achievement, you know, considering that's 2 to 5,000 people a day per, you know, vaccination center, of which there are 42.
Do we know,
so that's a really, you know, it's a really
at what
big
point
number.
They'll come out? Presumably the mass vaccination centers will not be for the elderly, it'll be more for sort of, you know, the rest of the population once the super vulnerable have been sorted out.
You'd imagine, I mean, I don't know about this, but I can't imagine, you know, for example, care homes, the vaccine's almost certainly going to just go to the care homes, you would imagine, wouldn't you? You wouldn't expect people from care homes to, you know, get themselves to these vaccination centers. I don't really know about how it's going to work with other people. This is the mass rollout. So Josh just mentioned that sort of hierarchy. These vaccination centres will be, to my understanding, just for when, you know, the vaccine gets rolled out to everybody, which will be a little while down the road and probably won't be until sort of early to mid next year. So yeah, I think that's a really. What do you make of that plan, Nelson? I feel like you haven't spoken for a little while.
It just makes sense in that life will only get back to normal when the vast amount of the population have been vaccinated. So it just makes sense to do whatever it takes and set up as many centres as it takes to vaccinate as many people as quickly as possible, because then we can get some sort of semblance of normality back to life.
Yeah,
I was thinking about this during our preparation. Like, at what point do in this rollout process do the sort of younger people, the non-vaccinated, at that point group, say they vaccinate everyone over 60, and there comes a point where the majority of the vulnerable people are vaccinated or who have chosen to be vaccinated, do they then like get rid of lockdown for the 20-year-olds? I know like 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds, like we're still at risk, but much less so. Do you think they'll open it? Obviously going to open up a lot more, but sort of to what extent?
Yes, and the reason I think I'm kind of confident on that is because Johnson announced today in the statement to the Commons that, and it was kind of vague and it was kind of short, but he said something along the lines of those in the third tier, so the highest tier, will be eligible for these 6 weeks of intense testing. So there'll be a lot of testing in those areas. And what he said was that at some point, hopefully January, those who test negative will be able to mix with other people who have tested negative. So because they know that those people don't have the virus and can't spread it asymptomatically, people will be able to mix. Now, I don't think that people are going to be able to mix just because they're sort of younger and less vulnerable. I think that while the vaccine's rolling out, those that are waiting to get the vaccine will then, you know, use it, because I don't think they're going to stop the increased testing just because the vaccine's being rolled out. I think they'll use that testing and the sort of the capacity that they've built of, you know, for mass testing to be able to test more people, more younger people. And while they're waiting to get the vaccine, those that test negative might be able to interact. I'm fairly confident that that's the way this is going to work, because they're already talking about rolling that out. Johnson already said that they're looking into doing that, hopefully for January, with a few tests to take, obviously a few tests to take place, you know, between now and then in different areas. I think he was talking about Liverpool again. So I'm optimistic that's how it's going to work. Do you disagree, Nelson? I don't know what.
No, I perfectly agree. It's like there's this plan. I think it's the same thing you're talking about, where if you've been identified as a contact of someone, they plan to test you every single day for a week, and you don't isolate until you test positive.
That was slightly different to what I was talking about, but that was also announced today. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's the fact that we're finally getting to a stage where we can use tests to loosen restrictions, and it's
Yeah.
And I think that's what's going to enable a more gradual approach. The restrictions won't be lifted overnight, but I think we're slowly going to return to how it was in the summer. And then we're going to stay in that summer period until most of us have had the vaccine. It's going to be lightweight restrictions, try and social distance, but it's okay if you don't. Shops are going to stay open, pubs are going to stay open. It's a gradual return to normality. And I think we're going to stay in that phase of it's okay, but be careful for a very long time still.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're saying about that, I think one of the things that is going to be an exception to that is this Christmas plan. But I think maybe that's best to discuss at a different time, because, you know, that's going to be announced tomorrow.
Yeah.
But I'm just hopeful, cautiously optimistic is probably a better phrase, that next Christmas will be back to how things were.
Ben. Very much like a politician, cautiously optimistic. That's a classic line.
Mystic.
Well, I don't want to. Yeah, I don't know. I'm
there by the grace of the British people. We will conquer this.
Yeah. Josh has shot down my rousing speech I wrote for this point here in the podcast.
Just too much.
So I'll have to be shelved for the next one.
I think we should. I think someone alluded to it earlier, but in terms of countries who are like less developed, aren't as able to acquire all of these doses of these vaccinations, you would expect it, but I think it's really good that they've sort of, the G20 I think have come together and sort of said we're going to help distribute it to these places that are most in need, to be honest. So I think that's really good that they're committing to it, and it's definitely something that should be at the forefront of government's minds, especially in this time of like seriously like global issue, to help each other out in terms of like I don't know whether it is like funding it or acquiring it or whatever, but whatever they can do to help needs to be done. I think it's good that they're doing it.
Well, look, I understand what you're saying. But I'm starting to wonder why, and maybe one of you two can explain this to me, but why has an international or a supranational body like the UN or the WHO, why haven't they lobbied for major Western countries to sign some form of agreement that they will purchase a certain amount of vaccines per country and distribute it, you know, certain percentage to themselves and donate a certain percentage to underdeveloped countries? Like, what? Why? Because I feel like things like that, where you're doing things for the benefit of the world. So, for example, a good example of this would be environmental policy, that you will sign something to say that you won't emit a certain amount. You're kind of, you know, putting forward funds from yourself, from your own country, to benefit the planet as a whole, and that's effectively what certain environmental agreements have done. So I don't know why an agreement similar to that hasn't been done for the vaccine, because as I said earlier, and as you've said now, Josh, you know, not only is it right to help, you know, underdeveloped countries, but also you can't get out of this unless you help them, because the virus will spread through airports and everything else. Like, the only way to truly defeat this is to defeat it in all countries. If you get rid of it in one country, it'll still, you know, creep back in.
Well, it comes down to something known as the free rider problem, in that if you know that others will step in, there is no incentive for you personally to step in. So because there is no organization that can actually legally commit all the countries to donating, the UN is legally weak in that domain.
I totally agree with you that it is weak, but it has been able. Well, I don't know whether it's weak, but I'll concede that point. You know, I'm not aware, but if you say it's weak, well, for the sake of argument, I'll concede that. Yeah, even if it is environmentalism, exactly. The Paris Accord is exactly what I was going to say. Like, they've succeeded before on that.
Yeah, but their success there has to be tempered with the fact that the Paris Accord is one of the weakest agreements on climate change, in that it puts the onus on the country and doesn't have any There is no mechanism to force a country
to
comply.
I understand that.
So you can just leave the Paris Accord like Trump did.
That's fine. That's absolutely fine. I totally understand what you're saying. But if you already start setting that up exactly the same, if you start setting that up and have a small group of countries already sign it, pressure builds for other countries to sign it, which, you know, as the Paris Accords have shown, even though countries can take themselves out of it, other than Trump, you know, many countries, and other than the US, many countries have remained in the Paris Accords. So why, you know, why wouldn't the same happen? I mean, I'm...
There would then be a debate as to which vaccines we buy, and there's going to be this economic nationalism of Russia's going to want to buy its vaccine, America's going to want to buy the Moderna vaccine, the UK's going to want to buy the Oxford vaccine, and there's going to be a massive debate there. The only good thing that's come out of this is I believe one of them has committed to giving the vaccine at cost to developing countries in perpetuity, but I don't know which one it was.
Right. Okay. I'm not saying that the point that I'm making is I'm not saying that countries haven't done well in purchasing the number of vaccines they already have. I'm not saying that countries haven't already, you know, don't promise to donate a certain number. I just find it bizarre that you've got these international bodies that can bring countries together for the good of the planet, which they've done on environmentalism, but that same pressure hasn't been applied to this, which is also a very pressing issue for the planet. And for, you know, for the health of just people everywhere. Like I don't understand why that pressure isn't there for this as well. But you know, maybe we'll see. I mean, if they donate any just without having to sign, if countries, you know, donate the vaccine without having to sign an international agreement, I suppose there's no need for an international agreement. So let's hope that they just donate them anyway. But so we're all in agreement then that we're sort of optimistic that this will be over
sometime
mid to late next year.
Please.
Please, yeah. What are you going to do, Josh, when this is all over? What are you looking forward to most?
I don't know. Probably see my girlfriend or something. Live life. Not that I really do anything anyway, but...
Yeah.
Just like maybe leave the house without sort of guilt.
Yeah. I'll come up to Newcastle once this is over and come see you for the first time. Will
Nelson, what are you going to do? Actually do regular uni things?
Uni things without restrictions and masks and social distance.
You're going to go to a more sort of intense Oxford Union with more people in there. More like the Commons Chamber.
More than just, I think it was like 25 in there.
Yeah,
it was just 25 listening to the EU ambassador. It was nice, but could have been better.
Yeah, we'll have to. I think we need to come up with some sort of like TLDR event for the end of lockdown. I think we've got to do something for
an office live stream
when
office
this
party.
Is all over. Live stream office party.
The office
all the jam
tiny.
In the world.
We need to do. I think more live streams. I think that's the way. Oh yeah, that's the thing. Before we go, actually, everyone. make sure to watch the Daily Briefing live stream on Monday. There'll be a link in the description with the live event in there. We're going to go through the 100 craziest stories of the year. We're going to do a proper live stream for it. So, make sure you watch it. It'll be great. It's going to be... I've still got to write all of them, so it might be a little bit of...
Have you got 100 stories now, or do you need more suggestions?
Please watch it. It's Daily Briefing at tldrnews.co.uk. So send your 100... crazy stories don't send all 100 because I won't use all 100 but send some for the 100 of your craziest stories from the year, and I'll hopefully include some of them. I think you might also get a prize, but I don't know, maybe you'd be entered into some sort of prize if you put them in, but I could be wrong, so maybe you don't. Send them out of the goodness of your heart. Don't do it for a reward.
Did anyone win that last competition, the American one?
I think we're
the
still
votes
ca-
are still
I think,
being
I think
counted.
We're waiting for the Electoral College. Yeah, I think we're just for sake of clarity, we're waiting for the Electoral College to vote. But anyway, good. Thanks for listening, everybody, and Daily Briefing on Monday, I guess.